Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with DVD audio, satellite radio, and MP3 capability. Learn more at Acura.com.
This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, getting the big shots to share their kibble in a dog-eat-dog industry. We'll talk to Tom Sherrick. He's a former studio chief and super fundraiser. Plus, on the occasion of Lindsay Lohan's rearrest, we revisit celebrity spin doctor Mike Citrin. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. This is The Business from NPR. We begin with news that the National Football League last week dipped a cleat into Hollywood by announcing it will produce its first ever theatrical feature, a biopic about iconic Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi. Variety noted that the NFL's involvement will give filmmakers access to the Packers' Lambeau Field, historical footage, and, quote, extensive marketing muscle. Sadly, just days after the announcement, the NFL's extensive marketing muscle tested positive for steroids and was fined heavily. In international news, Jackie Chan and China, two great tastes that don't go great together. Yes, Jackie Chan's new comedy, Rush Hour 3, debuts in the U.S. on August 10th, but no, it won't debut in China. An official statement from the state-run China Film Group to the AP called the market for Rush Hour 3, quote, relatively weak. This is a rare instance of the Chinese government actually telling the truth, even while obfuscating. Because the market for Rush Hour 3 is relatively weak, but not because the Chinese hate Jackie Chan. It's weak because piracy makes Chinese box office almost non-existent. Or, as the Chinese like to say, the problem with American movies is, you copy one, 2 hours later, you want to copy another. In other news, what does $350 million buy you these days? Well, a lot of kids posing as plump penguins, for starters. The Walt Disney Company purchased Canadian online sensation Club Penguin for $350 million last week, a virtual community that finally gets Disney into social networking. What? You've never heard of Club Penguin? Well, unless you're between the ages of 6 and 14, or have a kid that is, that's probably just as well. The site is a virtual playground for kids in which they appear on screen as corpulent cartoon penguins. The number of subscribers to Club Penguin nearly tripled in the United States over the past year, and its founders stand to make another $350 million if they meet performance targets through 2009. So, this March of the Penguins is heading all the way to the bank. Finally, Variety reports that Universal Pictures has made a 2-year first-look producing deal with Vince Vaughn and his Wild West Picture Show Productions. The arrangement kicks off with 3 features, each of which could be a starring vehicle for Vaughn. The first film in development there is called, and I kid you not, Male Doula. Why am I laughing? And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the program, spin doctor to Lindsay Lohan's room, stat. But next, shaking Hollywood's money tree for fun and profit. So, you think public radio is always in a pledge drive? In the fall, wealthy show business types can spend every night of the week attending some fundraiser or another. There's the Gala for Farm Animals, the City of Hope Spirit of Life Award, Operation Smiles Celebrity-Studded Annual Gala, and the Motion Picture Industry Charity's Lights, Camera, Auction event benefiting the American Stroke Association. And it's even thicker this year, with all the presidential hopefuls coming to town with their stovepipe hats in hand. Now, raising money in Hollywood is a lot like raising money anywhere. Only more so. Relationships mean more, the need to see and be seen is more important, and there's more guilt at having so much. But in some ways, Hollywood fundraising is also very different. Trust us, the annual Plumbers Ball in Muncie does not have paparazzi and a red carpet. Perhaps no other fundraiser is more Hollywood than the venerable Dinner of Champions, which raises millions to search for a cure for multiple sclerosis and helps the 2.5 million people living with its unpredictable and often debilitating symptoms. Just ask the heart and soul of the Dinner of Champions, Chair Emeritus and Ubermensch, Tom Sherrick. Sherrick was the head of the Fox Domestic Film Group and a 17-year vet of the studio when he left to become a partner in Revolution Studios. We talked to him in his office in Santa Monica. Tom Sherrick, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Tell me about Dinner of Champions. How long have you been doing this thing now?
This year will mark the 15th year that my wife and I have gotten involved in this dinner. 15 years ago, my daughter, well, more than 15 years, 17 years ago, my daughter was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And we made a decision at that point to do something and got involved with the Southern California MS Society. And that led us to taking over the dinner.
Mm-hmm. Where were you in your career when you started this? Sort of how old were you where in the pecking order of Hollywood?
I was at 20th Century Fox. I believe I was chairman of the domestic film group.
Who'd you call first?
Oh, wow. Who did I call first in the industry? I believe that the first person I told what was going on was Barry Diller. Mm-hmm. But I went in and I told him, and, you know, I never forget, I was pretty depressed, and he looked at me and said, okay, go deal with it. We'll help any way we can. Go deal with it. And the next thing I knew, it was that I was in charge of, this was a blessing in disguise. I mean, you talk about being blessed your whole life. Nobody has all good things happen to them in life. But you talk about being blessed. I was then put in charge of giving at Fox. In other words, when the solicitations came in for all these charities, they would come to me. And then I would give donations. And because at that time, Barry and Mr. Murdoch allowed me to do that, I was like Santa Claus, a Jewish Santa Claus, but I was Santa Claus. You sent me a thing, I sent you money.
How did you, it's one thing to sort of use a corporation that is kind enough or whose leadership is kind enough to let you go do those things. How does being the guy who sort of, you know, dials for dollars affect your business relationships and your celebrity relationships? I mean, ultimately, you're running, you know, production company.
You need to be really careful. You do.
Tell me about that.
I'll tell you about it. If I give to the head of Warner Brothers being honored, and now all of a sudden I'm running a dinner, I call up Warner Brothers and say, hey, let's see, Fox, Tom Sherrick's calling. Yeah, oh, they gave. Sure, well, yeah, what did you give? Oh, you gave $25,000? Yeah, we'll give you $25,000. That's the way it works. There's a give and take in the industry. You just can't keep taking. You have to be able to give, too. And so what happened was I was giving. I was allowed. The dinner became the dinner because Fox allowed me to be the person giving. And by giving, when I called, I would get back. That's the way it worked.
How do you shake the sort of individual money tree of Hollywood? First of all, who's your competition? As you were saying, that you're already involved in charities.
Yeah, I don't look at it as a competition. The only thing that becomes really competitive to me, if you're running a dinner, is the date it's on. Meaning that if you're on that date, you don't want anyone else on that date. You know, and there's so many dinners that it's very difficult. But there's a listing, and pretty much, if you're listed, if you've picked that date, and that date's based on when you can get the hotel or place that you're going to have the dinner, most people will stay away from your date. Most people. Doesn't mean that you don't have sometimes dueling, you know. And then, but once you're established and people know that the MS dinner is on that day, or the AFI dinner is on that day, other people will stay away from it because they want to get those people who might be coming to your dinner to their dinner. That's the only competitive thing. The idea of raising money being competitive, I don't look at it that way. And I'll tell you why I don't look at it that way. One of the things I learned about fundraising a long time ago, don't ever try to get into somebody's pocket. You cannot do that. You can ask them to give, but you cannot demand or be upset if they don't give you what you think. That doesn't work like that. You have to be able to get a gift and say thank you. And if we've had years that people gave and gave and gave, and we'd had years they'd have a bad year. And I'd call them and say, Tom, you know, it's not going really well this year. I said, great, be my guest at the dinner. What? I said, be my guest. I want you to come. You don't have to give me anything. Just come. But the dinner was supposed to be if you were coming to the MS dinner, you were coming because you wanted to be there. Now you could say to me, Tom, please, I tell you the truth. It's the way I feel. It's the way I feel about the industry. The industry, the motion picture industry, is a big family. Sometimes dysfunctional, but a big family. They care.
I want to talk about just the micro level for a second here.
Okay.
What are the politics of the seating charts? How political is that?
Yeah,
because people come to these things. They're okay. Not just coming to give money and right. to be part of this barter system that you described earlier.
Right.
But they're also going because they want to rub elbows. They've got a project they want to get greenlit. They have a show that
and
they
want. You
know
that he's not talking to him and she's not talking to her. And yes,
tell
that
me
happens.
About that.
No, it happens. You have to know.
Do you look at the map and go, oh, no. He cannot sit there.
Yes, I do.
Tell me about it.
Absolutely do. As big a business as we are, we're a small community. And when he's having a – when Sarah's having a fight with Archie, you're going to know about it. You know, I don't think that if Sumner Redstone and Shari Redstone came to the dinner this year, I'd necessarily have them on the same side of the room. Although they might make up, and then we'd have them on the same side of the room. But that kind of thing, there isn't much. If you know, you go out to lunch, and most people eat pretty much in the same places. You can hear almost any. Oh, he's not taught. Oh, did you hear what happened between? But one of the things we don't do, and I've always been really careful about this, is it's not inexpensive. Then there's only so many people that can sit in the pit. You know,
what is the pit?
The
first?
Pit is the place inside the hotel where the high roll, the people who give a lot of money sit, and that's $25,000 or more. So if someone's only able to give $15,000, then I can't put them in the pit. They could be my best friend, but it's not fair to the people who give me $25,000 to sit outside the pit because the pit is where. A lot of the chatter goes on and the thinking and call me and I'll call you. So you got to be really careful about that.
And you get lobbied to be put in the pit.
Well, you know, I don't. I know other organizations I belong to do get lobbied. I've never gotten a complaint about where someone was sitting in all the years I've been doing this. I actually had one executive, big company, who wasn't able to, because they gave me $15,000. And I remember the person saying to me, Tom, why aren't I in the pit? I said, they give $25,000. And I, as much as I'd like you, I got you as close as I can get you. He said to me, from now on, you're getting $25,000. I want to be there.
Let me ask you about, these are ultimately charity events. And at the same time, these are people who are used to a certain level of, shall we say, luxury in their lives. How do you balance the need for charity with the mode in which they are accustomed to being entertained?
I've go to a lot of dinners. My wife and I have been going to dinners for as long as we've been out here. I mean, there's so many dinners. And at each dinner, I try to see what works and doesn't work. You know, I watch what goes on. And I realize that people are coming to that dinner to come, say hello, do some schmoozing with other people, be entertained, and go home. They don't necessarily want to spend the night at the dinner. They have other things to do. So I came up with the idea, okay, I get that. I know that I come. I want to be seen. I want to show my support. And I don't want to go home. Entertain me a little bit and go home. So I immediately say, I got it. Here's what we're going to do. Dinner starts at 6:15. Could be cocktails till 6:45, half an hour. Saves the organization a lot of money by having drinks for only half an hour. And then get them inside. Put them inside. And the first thing they need to know when they're inside is you're going to be out of here at 9:45. Not at 10, not at 10:15, not at 10:30. Look at your watches. 9:45, you're going to be walking out that door. We tell them that. We've been telling them that for years. And everybody says to me afterwards, You did it again. You did it again. You got us out of here 9:45. You're absolutely right. It's home time for the news. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And then the other thing was, we never, ever, I never wanted to use talent to sell tickets. So on all our invitations, you'll never see who the talent is. And the idea with the talent was not for them to put on a whole show. Until last year, when Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons performed, which was a real kick. I mean, they were dancing in the aisles. I never, ever had a star or a celebrity perform giving me more than 2 songs, maybe 3.
Who are some of the people who've performed over the years?
Let's go. Bon Jovi, Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, Gladys Knight, Wayne Newton, the Four Seasons.
How do you balance the sort of seriousness of the charity with the need to have fun that night? I mean, okay.
The night is about, again, you have to deal with MS. The other thing is that I never wanted to deal with MS by having people break down by seeing people with serious advanced MS. So it became more about, the dinner became more about, what are we doing to help people and research this disease? What's happening? Giving them some time to understand what their money was going for, how that money was being used. The evening was an evening of celebration of being part of this organization, the MS Society, that part you play that night in being there. So it was never about long speech. I never want to go to a dinner, ever want to go where you have one long speech after another. To me, the dinner was about get in, have some fun. By the way, the MS dinner, there are so many people who I've worked with over the years who do so much that night and don't charge us. You know, 15 years of talent, all donated. And I'll tell you a great story. One year, we have someone who opens the show, because I find the best way to get people to sit in their seats is to open the show with somebody that they have to sit down for. And one year I had the UCLA marching band. One year I had to have the USC marching band. It puts people, you know, it's hard to get people quiet. So the idea was have two performers, one start the show and one end the show. So one year we went out and we were lucky enough to get Bon Jovi and Mariah Carey in the same year. And we had gotten Mariah Carey first, and she was going to close the show. Now, Bon Jovi's a pretty big name, and he now was going to open the show. And he agreed to do that. And the next thing I know, we're on the line with the manager, who was doing his job. You know, hey, it's going to cost this, he's going to cost that. And finally, it got so expensive. And don't forget, every nickel that if I had to pay for something, has to come out of what's going to go to help people or research. Finally, it got to a point, I said, you know what? We're going to have to pass on Bon Jovi. I can't justify in my mind us spending this kind of money to bring these people in. So we called the manager and said, listen, thank you very much, but we're going to pass, and we just don't have the funds to do that. Bon Jovi got on the phone and said, I'll pay for everything. I want to be there. He paid for everything.
Tom Sherrick is a partner in Revolution Studios. We spoke to him at his office in Santa Monica. Tom, thanks for being on The Business.
And don't forget, you're coming to the dinner this year.
What's the date?
September 24th, Century Plaza Hotel.
There's a link to the Dinner of Champions on our site at kcrw.com/thebusiness. A postscript: Revolution Studios is closing shop as we speak, and Tom Sherrick will be out of work for the first time in his long career. Asked how that will affect his ability to raise money from his high-powered friends, he said, I don't know. Coming up next, we need a spin doctor to Lindsay Lohan's room, stat! You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Hollywood scandal reached some new lows in the past year. While these events make titillating reading for our celebrity spellbound society, It's serious business for the stars involved. Lindsay Lohan's most recent run-in with the law has cast doubt about her role in her next film, aptly titled Poor Things, and in fact, on her future in the business at all. The fallout from a celebrity faux pas will determine how steep a price the star will pay. To minimize that cost, stars often turn to master spin doctors like Mike Citrick. The founder of Citrick & Company, which calls itself a strategic communications firm, Mike and his crew have become known as the masters of crisis management. Here's another listen to our conversation with Mike Citrick from a couple months back. Mike Citrick, welcome to the business. What are the basic precepts of crisis PR?
Well, the most important thing is, you know the facts before you open your mouth and know the facts before you develop a plan. Not only what you're going to disseminate, but equally important, if not more important, all of the facts of the situation. And information is power in our business.
Why is it not okay to just tell the simple truth? And have your clients ever rejected your PR plan in favor of telling the simple truth? And how's that worked out?
Well, we do tell the simple truth, but you have to tell it in a way that has an impact. We always tell the truth.
Well, I'm using the modifier, the simple truth.
Well, but
as in,
what is the simple truth? I mean, look, many people would say the simple truth would be, you know, I had too much to drink, I shouldn't have been driving, and I'm sorry. Well, that leaves a big unanswered question. What about the next time you go out to dinner or go to a party? Are you going to get behind the wheel? And I think those are important questions that need to be answered when you're dealing with a crisis.
In Hollywood, it seems like there are two kinds of approaches, even before we get to I'm sorry or this is what I'm going to do. But the first seems to be no comment. And it seems to be by far the most prevalent approach to crisis PR is to go armadillo, roll into a ball and hope they don't, you know, eventually they'll lose interest. The other theory is if you don't tell your story, someone else will. So you should help frame the debate. Which is your philosophy and are they ever mutually exclusive?
Look, sometimes you have to take your lumps and not comment. But with us, that's very much the exception, not the rule. The safest thing for a public relations person or a publicist to do is to tell their client, look, the media is evil. They're only out to get you. Don't comment. It's just going to make it worse. And then when a story comes out, they say, see, look at that evil journalist. And, you know, I don't think you're serving your client that way. About a decade or so ago, I published a book, and in the book I said, if you don't tell your story, someone else will tell it for you. And that's true. There are three words that a pundit just can never bring himself or herself to say, and that's, I don't know. And therefore, they'll opine on anything, whether or not they have any idea about which they're talking.
Speaking of scandals of that ilk, Michael Richards, Mel Gibson, Rush Limbaugh, Chris Albrecht, Don Imus – does it seem like there's more scandal now than there has ever been?
You know, people have been speculating for a long time about the impact of the internet. And if you want to see the impact of the internet, it is the proliferation of scandals. Not that the internet is causing the scandals by any means, but what happens is it's very easy to get information to a website, to have that website, especially if it's information about a celebrity, publish it. And the website then is picked up by the more traditional media, and hence you have the scandal. So you take Kim Basinger and Alec Baldwin's child and the tape that was leaked to TMZ. The question is, how would that story have played and would it have played if the internet weren't so prevalent today? And you can go Michael Richards. You know, you had the cell phone video go up on a website. Website then was picked up by the more traditional media, and hence you had the scandal there.
How can you use the web to serve your clients' interests?
Well, we use the web quite a bit. You have to be very careful with the internet now to react quickly. So we have what we call a truth squad. And a truth squad is a group of people who monitor all of the media, the websites, the traditional media, for news on our clients. And when something pops up that is inaccurate, we immediately go to that website or go to that broadcast facility or go to that newspaper and demand a correction and show them why they're wrong. We had something that broke one time at midnight on AP on a celebrity client. And we, before we could even get to them, this was within minutes, it was on the CNN website. So we had one of our partners, who's a former city editor of a major daily newspaper, call AP and call CNN, pointed out what was wrong. The correction went up before it spread any further. So that's why you have to move quickly.
With so much money available to them and so many resources available to them, how is it that celebrity PR can go so wrong sometimes? I'm thinking of the Michael Richards appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman. How can it go so badly?
First of all, the clients don't always listen to you. Second, there are a lot of incompetent people in my business. You know, there are a lot of people who do crisis PR who think it's just like any other PR, and it's not.
What's the difference?
We prepare our clients for a media interview the way a lawyer prepares his client or her client for trial. And we put them through mock interviews, and we even film them so they can see what they look like. It's a big deal, and it isn't taken lightly, especially something where the stakes are that high. And our questions will be much tougher than your questions would be because we'll cross the line to try to get a reaction out of them. And then when they react, we will explain to them how they need to react to make this right.
So you already know what their breaking point is.
Well, we try to push and see if they have a breaking point. And if they do, then how do they deal with it? How do they deal with a question that's completely over the line?
And what is the standard answer you say when someone goes over the line? Is there a standard reply? Are you supposed to say, well, I'm not going to answer that?
It depends what the question is. It may be that you say, look, you know, I'm happy to answer that, but that has nothing to do with that which we're talking. Or you may want to say, look, I just don't feel it's appropriate to answer that. I'm sorry. And you know, what's your next question? But as you know, broadcast journalists will often use the pause to get a person to continue to talk. And so we'll have a conversation. You'll just wait to see if I keep talking as I'm doing now. And the tendency is to fill in that blank, and we have to explain to the client to say, okay, have you got any other questions?
I'm kidding. How long have you been doing this now?
Probably 37, 38 years.
Is it getting harder?
In some ways it's getting harder. In some ways it's getting easier. But you've got to be ever vigilant. You've got to be ever resourceful. And you have to really learn your trade in order to do what we do. This is not a place for on-the-job training. And we're dealing in some cases with people's freedoms, with people's lives, and with companies' lives. So these are important assignments, and we take them as such.
Any free advice for people in sticky situations?
Make sure you think before you act.
See, I set you up there.
Well, they can certainly call me or someone in our firm.
Mike Sitrick is the CEO of Sitrick & Company, a crisis communications specialist if there ever was. Mike, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.